newspress.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Deckers, makers of Uggs and Tevas, PLFON Wendy Foster offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines, Montecito Bank and Trust proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter, and CSU Channel Islands. No matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. Welcome, everyone. We have a very interesting guest today. In fact, I don't think I've ever introduced a guest by reading something from their website, but this bio that Elaine Gale, who is an author and the interim chair of the BA program at Antioch University, has such an interesting bio. I think I need to read it so you can get a sense of who she is. About me, I'm an armchair symbologist, and we're going to talk about what that means, wear pajamas to run errands, am not domestically inclined, still love to read print newspapers, and have eaten smoked cobra. I dislike waxy apples, pretension, and humidity. I love possibility, making paper loose leaf tea, the Sonora Desert, dancing of all kinds, playing the
djembe.
Insubordination, finding meaning in the ordinary, traveling, and laughing uncontrollably. So welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. Thanks, Neil.
So this is out of order, but what is a symbologist? Is that a religion? Some kind of ailment? What is
it? Well, it's not. But I really like the phrase armchair symbologist. And I think I was accused of that by a friend at one point, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And it's always stuck with me as being a part of my identity. And I think it really taps into my writer side, mm-hmm. where I'm paying attention to metaphors or symbols or, you know, things that repeat, or, you know, an extra layer of interest that parallels something that's happening. So I'm always trying to uncover meaning and find that kind of hidden symbol in something.
You know, when I was in high school, I read William Golding's book, the one where all the kids go crazy. What was the name of that book? Lord of the Flies.
Oh, Lord of the Flies,
and,
right.
The teacher told us that there are symbols in this book, and I want you as an assignment to look at every symbol and tell it, list them that you can find and explain what it means. And there was a conch on in one of the scenes, and we had this sort of this interpretation of what that meant. And I thought I was really smart. And about 10 years later, William Golding was interviewed on some television show.
Uh-huh.
And he said, it's amazing. He said, you know, people come to me and talk about all the symbols they found. I didn't have any symbols in the book. but it's about, you know, the thing that's interesting,
yeah.
But he did, because art can be interpreted by the in a way that makes sense to the viewer. And I think literature can also just awaken senses and provide for symbols that maybe the author didn't explicitly think about.
I think that's right. I mean, sometimes there's real intentionality and craft that go into it, and sometimes it's unintentional, and that, you know, whoever's consuming the art, you know, brings everything that they are and their experiences and their history and their beliefs on, you know, into something. So I love that example. That's why I say it's an armchair symbologist. Like, there's not a degree involved. I didn't go to school. It's just something that really interests me as I'm moving through life, how we all make a meaning of things.
So listening to your accent, it sounds like you come from New York like I do. Is that true? You're a New Yorker, aren't you?
No. I'm a sixth generation Nebraskan. So I'm very Midwestern. You know, I say binder clips and reuse tea bags and wave to everyone. So it's a very, you know, I'm a very Midwestern person. But I've ended up in California for 15 years now. So I absolutely love it out here.
A wise choice. So
very.
You've had, you have had and you still have many careers going for you. Right now, you're the interim chair of the BA program at Antioch. Tell us about that.
Well, it's been a really interesting position in terms of being at a university that has social justice in their mission. And I feel like right now, in particular, it feels really poignant and important to have that be part of the mission statement of the university. It's something that makes it very unique, and it's, of course, part of the Antioch history. In fact, I have been, you know, associated with Antioch and working for their PhD program in leadership and change for 12 years. So every year in the program, we get a T-shirt, right? And there's a quote by Horace Mann, who's the founder of Antioch, on the T-shirt that says, "Be ashamed to die until you've won some victory for humanity." And I'll wear it out running, you know, and people will say, "Oh, let me read your shirt." And it's always like, whoa, you know, no pressure, you know. But there's something about the spirit of that. You know, what can we contribute to the world? And what are we going to bring to what's our shared humanity about that really appeals to me, both as an educator and an artist? Because I'm actually an accidental academic. I've been a journalist and an artist forever and then stumbled into academia, 10 years ago. So,
well, this is a particularly difficult time, I would imagine, or maybe an opportunistic time to be involved with social justice, given what's going on politically in this country and around the world. In fact, today the Dutch elections took place, and I'm happy to report, as far as I could see on Google, that the right-wing candidate lost by a large amount. But there is certainly, if you look at this, the congressman from Iowa's comments 2 days ago, a sense that social justice for many people isn't high on their list of priorities.
Right. And I think for me, that's why it's been so meaningful to have that as the backdrop of this education. You know, that's not true, like if you're at a state school or if you're, you know, at some private universities. But at this university, it's saturated in the curriculum. It's part of our core learning objectives. It's part of what we bring to the classroom. And then the privilege of being able to teach these small classes is just incredible. So at the state school where I have tenure, it's the classes have grown really large. Like when I first got there, there were 18 students, and now there's 40. Mm-hmm. So I think at Antioch, you know, our average classes are between 15 and 25. And in that way, you can really connect to the students and build that, you know, interpersonal glue that I think can really mentor them and where they feel that sense of caring leadership in the classroom. And that's important to me.
And is there more conversation this year about social justice given the political landscape?
Definitely.
And are people, I know in AHA, I understand that there are many of the Hispanic kids are really scared stiff for their families, for their friends. Is there any sense of fear? Not just theoretical disgust with some of the political discourse, but also some fear.
Absolutely. I definitely think, and on the part of students and faculty, you know, fear if people are immigrants or fear if people are, you know, in groups that aren't going to be protected anymore. Like if you're gay or lesbian or, you know, transgender or bisexual, you know, what some of the groups that are under fire right now in the social justice arena, that's definitely a concern. And I see it not just in the classroom with students, but also amongst the faculty and the administration as well.
What did you think of the incident at Middlebury College last week? Middlebury College, as we know, is one of the finest liberal arts schools in the country, and yet even they ended up with the left acting almost like you would think of the right by well, what happened at Middlebury is a very liberal school. The author of a very racist book 25 years ago was invited to speak, and the students not only disrupted his presentation, but actually attacked him. And it was just appalling. And so, you know, I just want to be clear that there are people on the extreme on both ends of the political spectrum. And, you know, one of the things that I think everyone has to, you know, take a deep breath and understand that everyone's feelings have to be considered. You're listening to AHA Presents on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Founded by a UCSB grad, Deckers Brands has grown into a global driver of lifestyle footwear. From humble beginnings in 1973, Santa Barbara has been a key element of the business, defining the company's culture, providing home base for many employees, and inspiring product innovation each year. For a first-hand experience, stop by the Deckers Brands headquarters in Goleta, 250 Coromar Drive, from 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, 11 to 5 Sunday, and shop their new brand showcase retail test lab. Guaranteed, you'll see a new side to Deckers portfolio, from footwear to handbags to home furnishings.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafon Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafon Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership and has repaired over 35 homes through the Your Brush with Kindness Home Repair Program. This spring, Habitat will begin construction on its fourth affordable housing development in Southern Santa Barbara County. Located in Carpinteria, Habitat will build three new affordable homes available for homeownership by qualified low-income families. Support Habitat by volunteering, becoming a monthly donor, or shopping at the Habitat Restore. More information can be found at sbhabitat.org or calling 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. We're here with Dr. Elaine Gale, author and interim chair of the BA program at Antioch University. You know, Elaine, I'm looking at the list of degrees, and you have degrees from the University of Denver, BU, Antioch, and Oxford and Grenoble you attended, but the one degree that I think needs to be mentioned is Boston University. And this is going to surprise you. The reason BU is so important is I have my undergraduate degree from BU.
Oh, wow.
We have not discussed this.
Wow. What did you study, Neil?
I studied parties.
me too. How
funny. I actually had a very famous, history because the fraternity I belonged to on Bay State Road, I think, was the model for Animal House. Now, that's not true. It was actually in Dartmouth. But I had a very similar experience. But I did enjoy it, and I did better at my graduate school. But I did like going to BU. So we have something in common. And after the show, we should do the secret Boston University handshake.
Okay, you're on.
So so you've been involved in academia, but let's step back a second. You were also a journalist. Tell us about that.
I was a journalist for a long time. And it ties back to Boston University, actually, because I went in as a communication major, but ended up switching my undergraduate degree to religion and English and then studying abroad for a year because I was just so taken with the liberal arts. You know, I would sign up for classes like the theology of Christian mysticism, you know, and it just was fascinating to me. And I also was able to take classes with Elie Wiesel, who was a professor there, of course, until he passed away this year. So there were amazing people there, and it was such a privilege. So what happened is I ended up getting an internship at the Boston Phoenix, which was an amazing alternative weekly in Boston. And Carolyn Knapp was my mentor there, who was an amazing author and wrote books called Drinking a Love Story, among others. So she took me on and mentored me. And from there, I ended up getting a job at the Utney Reader in Minneapolis and then started my career at the Minneapolis Star Tribune with an advice column and being a pop culture reporter there. So I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but that grounding in the liberal arts was incredibly important because, you know, it's wonderful to learn how to communicate, but to have a rich body of knowledge to communicate about was really helpful for me. So that's how I started my career. And then I ended up it was funny because my dad said when I was in college, well, Elaine, you know, a religion degree is not very practical. You know, I'm from the Midwest, so this is a Midwestern father here. And I said, come on, Dad, you know, I'm gonna use this degree. And then the Los Angeles Times recruited me to be one of their religion reporters because of my degree. So that was a great moment for me where I was able to say, this degree actually was practical after all. It's a big surprise, but...
So you were a journalist and... you know, we talk about journalism today so differently than when I was growing up, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on today's, what's going on with today with journalism is basically two sides of a political battlefield.
The journalism industry right now is fascinating to watch, and, you know, for a lot of us who were involved from, you know, a long time ago, like the 90s, we feel like there was a big crash when so much of the media merged and a lot of the journalism jobs went away. And the newsroom is this very staffed and employed and thriving place changed. It became more of a skeleton crew and more of a ghost town. And so a lot of us left in around 2000 and, you know, 2005. And so it really has changed, but I feel like there's an impact of that because really the journalists are the gatekeepers of democracy. And if we're not investing in them and giving them the money and the funding and the tools that they need to go be that fourth part of the government and watching things and reporting on them in an objective way, it really does a disservice to the public good. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that now. Of course, citizen journalism changed things and the 24/7 cable news changed things where people, you know, if you're in the media, you're so hungry for content. And we became content providers instead of journalists in some ways and became very isolated. Instead of in a newsroom, in a community, covering a local community, things got very diffuse and very isolated. And so I think that there's been a cost for that. So it's been interesting to watch right now and to see what's happening. So we'll see. I think journalism is going to come back stronger than ever.
Richard Brooks, one of the supposed Republican columnists at the New York Times, although he sounds more and more like a Democrat these days, has talked for the last several years about what sociologists talk about now is the atomization of society, where society is breaking up into back to tribes. And he talks about religion as one of the solutions that is there and problems. That is, people, you know, sort of identify with their religion and become more tribal. But the other hand, religion can give people a sense of goodness as well. I don't know, does religion, your religious history, give you any insight into what this country should be doing?
Oh, that's such a beautiful question. Covering religion for 4 years was such a privilege because what you started to see were all the things we had in common. So when I would go out for the Los Angeles Times and talk to people of different faiths, it was fascinating to me to see these themes repeated again and again and again, no matter if they were part of one of the world's big religions or a smaller fringe religion. There are so many things that shared humanity, that common good, you know, the idea of doing unto others. And it was amazing what we actually have in common. And so often religion divides people. But when you sit back and listen to people and think about it more thematically, there's so much that we can build on. And I think the whole ecumenical movement does that in a beautiful way. And, you know, now I call myself a free-range spiritualist, because I'm not really associated with one particular theology. And so that's where I have ended up. But I agree with you that there's a lot that we can learn right now from religion, spirituality, faith, having faith in each other, having faith in, you know, even a more secular humanism.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, you in one sentence you use the word a religion and spirituality, and I think that there's a really big difference between the two. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the religious fervor and the belief that you have the truth that's caused a lot of the problems, whereas a spiritual person doesn't necessarily have to possess something that's unique to that person, and everyone else is wrong.
It's more on that bed of relativism.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think the problems of the world could be solved if you and I were in charge, don't you think?
Well, clearly.
I mean, there's no reason. I don't understand why they have. You're a writer. And writing is a gift that really provides an opportunity to either entertain, but also to make a difference in the world and to express ideas. So what kind of writing do you do? Not teaching, but what kind of writing do you do?
Personal writing.
Yeah.
Well, all my writing is nonfiction. So the things that really interest me are what's true and what's happening in people's lives that we're not talking about. So that's what I'm interested in. Is
fake truth or truth?
Truth.
Truth. Okay.
Yeah,
so I'm
right,
sure.
Right. That's right. thank you. So I'm always trying to mine my own experience and mine what's true for me. And sometimes it's different. And that's part of what makes nonfiction interesting is one day something will be true for you. You'll put it away. Right. And then in 2 months, you look at it again. And a new layer has emerged for you about this experience. So it's almost like you're excavating yourself a little bit when you're doing nonfiction work. So my work has always centered on nonfiction. I guess I'm interested in that phenomenon that when you're sitting around a campfire with friends and, you know, you're telling a story and somebody leans in and says, is this true? Hmm. You know, because the question matters. If it's true, we consume it differently. We interact with it differently. It means something different to us.
And the question also is, you know, what's fiction and nonfiction? There is now, you know, the lines have been blurred. There's a book that I'm trying to think of the name of that I'm reading right now by a very famous author that is supposedly nonfiction, but it's totally fiction. Do you know the book I'm talking about?
No.
It's a bestseller.
Think of it at the break.
I'll think of it at the break.
Good.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about, you know, nonfiction fiction is that what I have always been told is that the most compelling writing is one in which speaks of something that you've experienced. I know that's not true for every writer, but to some extent, even nonfiction has some elements of the experience of the writer, I would imagine.
Definitely. And for me, I did a lot of comedy work. I was doing stand-up comedy. I was doing improv comedy. And I wanted to learn how to tell a more full story that includes the sad and the happy to show both sides of the coin. So,
well, it's too bad I didn't meet you a year ago because head of HA is someone that last year I went to stand-up comedy school with.
Oh, nice.
And I have to tell you,
it
was fantastic, but it was so different. You know, stand-up comedy is not telling jokes, not being a wise guy. Every single word and pause has to be
crafted.
And, you know, I thought it was really interesting.
Were you funny?
I think I was hilarious. I don't know if everybody, but the graduation is to do a 5-minute stand-up.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so, you know, but we had friendly audience, so that was good. Nobody threw profanities at us and said, get off. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramar Drive in Goleta.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership and has repaired over 35 homes through the Your Brush with Kindness Home Repair Program. This spring, Habitat will begin construction on its fourth affordable housing development in Southern Santa Barbara County. Located in Carpinteria, Habitat will build three new affordable homes available for homeownership by qualified low-income families. Support Habitat by volunteering, becoming a monthly donor, or shopping at the Habitat Restore. More information can be found at sbhabitat.org or calling 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, improving attitude, creating social harmony, bridging the achievement gap for teens. We're here with Elaine, Dr. Elaine Gale, author and interim chair of the BA program at Antioch University. So we talked about writing. Tell us about the BA program.
Well, the BA program is fantastic. We have 160 students, and we have 8 concentrations that you can specialize in. And we actually, for a BA in liberal studies, and we have 3 new degrees that we have approved and that will be being advertised and marketed in the next couple weeks. So we're really excited about
that.
And what are they? They're applied degrees. So a BA in applied arts and media, a BA in applied arts, and a BA in business leadership and technology.
When I was teaching, City College. I was teaching finance, and some of the kids would say to me, "It's important to take business." And I said, "No, it's not important to take business. What's important is to take a liberal arts courses, because you can always get a graduate degree, or you can learn business by working. But if you want to have a well-rounded true education, you need to do liberal arts." And I would imagine, as being the head of the BA program, you would agree with that. That makes for a fuller person.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's really what our curriculum is built on. But these concentrations are nice because they do allow for some pragmatism within the soup of liberal arts. So, you know, our biggest concentration is psychology. We have 60 psychology students. And then our next biggest concentration is business, mm-hmm. with 40 students, and then 20 communication and media students. And then from there, we go into the liberal arts and education and environment and some like that. So it is a very big program and concentration. And we have an MBA program. So a lot of students are choosing to do a pathway and go straight from our program into the MBA program. And you do get a credit, tuition credit, and some other things for doing that. So that's great.
And we talk now about your administrative role. You actually are in the classroom as well?
Yes.
And what do you think of teaching?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite things to it's a privilege and a joy, and it's a blast, and it's also something I take really seriously all at the same time, to have these students in your hands and, you know, also in your heart. They become part of your family. It's funny because we just wrapped a quarter at Antioch, and I left them to do the evaluations, and I started crying in the hallway because it's so sad sometimes as a professor. In a way, there's some loneliness there. You create these beautiful communities with your classroom, and then they're over mm-hmm. every 10 weeks. So it means a lot to me.
Well, that's what I did. When I taught, I would tell my students, if you're a student of mine, I give you a lifetime opportunity, if you're interested, to have coffee with me at Starbucks in Montecito anytime for the rest of your life. And we can talk. And people come back and they talk. And
yeah,
I think that's
very
fulfilling to hear what the stories, the successes and the failures.
Well, and I think for me, I don't have kids. So it's a way for me also to contribute to the younger generation in a way that's not directly and genetically, but it's a way that I contribute my spirit or my energy, you know, or my time or my investment of care and love for people, you know, that way.
And your bio says that you have a passion for building community. I guess teaching is one of the ways you can do that.
Definitely.
Let's talk about teaching. You know, one of the things that comes up on this show all the time is the question of equality. And now I'm talking specifically about equality in the classroom. And, you know, whether it's, you know, the junior highs or the high schools particularly, how do you create an environment where everyone has an opportunity to learn, given that people come from different backgrounds. You know, some kids have tutors and parents who are willing to help with the homework, and others have parents that either aren't there or have none of the resources. So how do you provide for building a community with an equality with a disparate group of students?
Well, that's definitely an issue in any place I've ever taught, is that issue of disparity and people coming in with different support, different levels of support and different levels of readiness. But I think for me, one of the most important things for me is to create and cultivate a classroom that feels safe and where people feel connected, not only to me, but to each other. So for me, it's important in the beginning, especially with the kinds of topics I teach. So I teach public speaking and I teach nonfiction writing. So those are classes that are very personal. There's a lot on the line. You know, people would rather die than speak in public. So these are sensitive areas that require a feeling of safety, and they require a feeling of connective tissue among each other in the classroom interpersonally. So that's one of the first things that I try and build. With each other, is that we get to know a little bit about who we all are, what we care about, what qualities do we bring in the classroom that are strengths for all of us, and also what are some things that we could use help with. And in a really practical level, we have a writing center on campus, and there are math tutors, and you know, there are ways that we can help bolster and support students in their learning. But I'm from the, you know, theoretical foundation that all learning starts with relationships and with that trust. And so that's something that I start with, because I think when people feel more comfortable, then they can build from there. They can build on what they're good at. So I'm always interested in bolstering and supporting and encouraging what people are great at, and then also being a coach and looking at the things that they could use support in, but really leading with their strengths.
So, does the school affirmatively do remediation? So someone comes out of high school, you've accepted the person, but they're really not ready for prime time. Does the school have the resources to do remediation, so to teach them basic English skills that they don't have? I know that a lot of the problems at City College is they come in and they can't write. Is the admission process, you know, robust enough so that's not an issue for Antioch?
The admissions process is robust, and we do look really carefully at the essays, and some of them just are incredible. You know, people who need a second chance, and they want to, you know, they may not have done well before, but they really are committed now, and they want to have to come in and have somebody just take a chance on them. And those are the students that I always say yes to, because people have taken a chance on me before and given me chances, and I want to extend that to someone else who is, you know, maybe a you know, somebody who's coming back to school at 60 or something like that. And we do have a really robust writing center, and they do all kinds of incredible work on campus that helps support students in their writing. And so it's led by Dr. Allison Adelman, and it's just a fantastic resource, and not everyone has that. Of course, City College has a wonderful one as well.
When I retired, and before I moved to Santa Barbara, I decided that my next stop in life was to write a novel. So I went to the New School, which is in the Village of New York, to take writing. There were 23 students. 22 were 21-year-old girls that I think just all graduated from VASA, and me. And the teacher made fun of me. She would call on me and she'd say, "Hey, Wall Street," because I was wearing this suit and tie, and would ask the perspective of an older person. So sometimes the classroom could be intimidating for someone even as old as I was. But it was a great deal of fun to be in a writing class with a bunch of 21-year-olds.
How did you feel as a non-traditional student in
that
way?
I think the funniest thing was I went on vacation one week, and I asked a girl sitting next to me if I could get the homework, because there was a homework assignment every week where you wrote something based on what the assignment was. So I was this was in New York, but I was in Tucson, and I was at the hotel. I called her home, as it turned out, and I said, "Is, you know, Susan there?" And her mother said, "Who's calling?" And I said, oh, it's Neil from her class. And, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, if we had phones that you could see, I was going to get arrested. But I was calling this 21-year-old girl to speaking to her mother for help. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Deckers Brands, the parent company of global lifestyle footwear brands UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Anu, invite you to experience their new brand showcase firsthand in Goleta. Discover new product, try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand, and get a peek into the company's headquarters. The brand showcase is open for business Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta. See you out there.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership and has repaired over 35 homes through the Your Brush with Kindness Home Repair Program. This spring, Habitat will begin construction on its fourth affordable housing development in Southern Santa Barbara County. Located in Carpinteria, Habitat will build three new affordable homes available for homeownership by qualified low-income families. Support Habitat by volunteering, becoming a monthly donor, or shopping at the Habitat Restore. More information can be found at sbhabitat.org or calling 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. We're here with Dr. Elaine Gale, author, interim chair of the BA program at Antioch University, and we've talked about her experience as a journalist, as a writer, as a teacher, as a stand-up comedian. And now we can talk about her experience as both a writer and a performer. And you have a show coming up called One Good Egg. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I'm really excited about it. I wrote it here in Santa Barbara. I moved here 2 years ago from Sacramento, and I found
that must have been a tough decision. I mean, Sacramento's got some of the most beautiful weather and places.
Beautiful trees. They have gorgeous trees there.
Right.
Yeah. No, Santa Barbara. The beauty of Santa Barbara is unsurpassed. I don't even know where people go here on vacation. I mean, this is the most beautiful place.
Sacramento.
Yeah.
That makes us feel better when we come home.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's been Santa Barbara's been this incredible amniotic sac for me. It's just the most creative geography I've ever lived in. And I absolutely love it. I love the people. I love the feel of this place and the energy. And so I've ended up birthing this play called One Good Egg. And it is going to be put up at Center Stage Theater in May, from May 5th to 7th. And I found the most amazing director in town, Rod Latham, who's a beloved Santa Barbaran and has been here for decades. And feel so lucky to have this incredible creative team helping me on it. It's actually a solo show, but the irony of that is that it's never solo. We have this huge team of people who are helping us manifest this project. And actually, the show on Friday night is a benefit for two organizations that I care a lot about that represent the beginning of life and the end of life. So Direct Relief Women and Hospice of Santa Barbara. So we're going to be raising hopefully $10,000 for them to donate to them on Friday night. So the show itself is called One Good Egg. And the themes, there's a lot of egg themes in the show. Mm. But it started out as this inquiry. My husband and I were going through some fertility treatments for, and I say that for a long time we were. And I started to wonder about, you know, you read all these fertility books and they always end with, well, and then the person, you know, drank kale four times a day for a year and then they got pregnant at 46 or something. So I started to wonder as the years went by, what happens when you don't get the baby? So what happens in life when you don't get the dream that you've hoped for? How do you integrate that loss into your life? And how do people live with loss in their life? So that's part of how the show was created. That's kind of the primordial soup of the show. And then it evolved into some other themes as well. So it's really a show about loss, and it's also a show about hope and forgiveness and celebrating life while sustaining loss.
I take it it's not a comedy.
It's both.
Oh, it is. Oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of comedy in the show, actually. I've always been really interested how, you know, when you laugh so hard, you cry, or when you cry so hard, you laugh. And that's what was really limiting for me in stand-up comedy, is that I wanted to explore the lows and talk about, you know, how that human experience of really feeling like you've lost everything, and where do you go from there? And you realize when you're writing it, there's an incredible amount of comedy that is just organically woven into that. So it's actually both, which has been really thrilling for me artistically.
Yeah, so many of the greatest stand-up comedians are really depressed people in real life. So there's no surprise there. So the show One Good Egg, you have a website, www.onegoodeggshow.com. It's a very clever website you chose.
Thank you, Neil.
Did you have trouble getting that, onegoodeggshow.com?
I didn't. I felt very happy about
that. So if you're interested, and you should be, both to help direct relief women and the Hospice of Santa Barbara and see a really good show, you can call 963-0408 or go online to onegoodeggshow.com. So what else are you working on? Are you writing something else besides?
Well, I started writing the memoir version to the show first, actually, and I have 350 pages of the memoir version. And I ended up, there's just something about performing that just caught me. I just was so compelled by this experience of being embodied and telling the story with so much at stake in a live theater, you know, and have it be presenced and three-dimensional, that I ended up kind of shelving the two-dimensional manuscript for a while. I just was so compelled to take the show into this arena of theater. And so now, once the show's over, I want to go back to that 350-page manuscript and really shape it up and revise it and get really committed to having that go out into the world in the next year.
So what's your interest for the next few years? To teach, still teaching and still writing and still performing? And
yeah, definitely. It's some kind of mix of that. I think for a long time I was a teacher who also wrote, and then I became, you know, a writer who also teaches. So it's some mix of that for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you as a former teacher here in town, it's very difficult to make a living teaching, no matter how rewarding it is emotionally.
We're definitely not overpaid.
Yeah, definitely.
There's no fear there.
You're definitely not overpaid. So when you look at these kids coming through school, do you ever look back and see how successful they are? And when you make that determination, what's success? Is success financial? And today there is such a great deal of talk about making all schools have federal funds based upon how well they do, which is going to be based on how much money they make. So, you know, how do you, in this kind of environment, do you value education? Is it about how much money you make, or is it about how happy you are? Is it about how you contribute to society? What are the things that make for a successful person?
Well, I think there are so many metrics that you can apply to that question of success. And I think that if we're just applying financial, that it's not a full picture of what's possible for people. It reminds me of the triple bottom line now, people, planet, and profit, that we have to include our humanity and we have to include our environment along with profit. So I would say that, you know, we all have this calling in our minds and this dream and this thing that we're here for. And sometimes it takes us a while to do it. I'm from a family of late bloomers. So you know, some people know right away and they just have that beeline and that vision and they move forward towards it immediately. And there's nothing wrong with wanting money. Money's wonderful. It can create freedom and possibility for people. And, you know, it's creative in itself. But I think that that individual concoction is very personal for people. But I do hope, like with the new conception of a triple bottom line, that we do include our humanity and we do include community and we do include our heart and our bodies, you know, along with our pocketbook. So I think that any way that you can build a life that's as embodied and as balanced as possible, that it helps everyone involved. So
yeah, well, you know, we're talking to each other and we're both agreeing, but my lack of optimism is somewhat tempered by the reality of what's taking place in this country now,
right?
Politically, and you know, the whole notion of cutting back on education. I think the latest polls show that a very big percentage of American voters don't rate education as a high priority, and I think that education not only should be a high priority, but a specific kind of education, one that provides you with the opportunity to really discover what your passion is rather than take, you know, accounting, because accounting is a good way to make a living.
Right.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education, and believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
For more than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers Brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers Brand Showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coramore Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership and has repaired over 35 homes through the Your Brush with Kindness Home Repair Program. This spring, Habitat will begin construction on its fourth affordable housing development in Southern Santa Barbara County. Located in Carpinteria, Habitat will build three new affordable homes available for homeownership by qualified low-income families. Support Habitat by volunteering, becoming a monthly donor, or shopping at the Habitat Restore. More information can be found at sbhabitat.org or calling 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. We're here with Dr. Elaine Gale, author, interim chair of the BA program at Antioch University, and among other things, a storyteller. What is a storyteller?
Well, so I have learned a lot about taking my work from the page to the stage in the last couple of years, and the whole storytelling movement that the organization called The Moth is bringing to light and making so popular. In fact, The Moth is coming here April 13th at the Libero, which is going to be an amazing show. And actually, a friend of mine from Boston University, where I went to undergrad, is the artistic director of The Moth. So Catherine Burns. So it's a very small world. But I've been driving down more and more to Los Angeles for more storytelling events. And I was thrilled to see the AWC, the Women in Communication chapter here in Santa Barbara, is doing a storytelling event next month here in Santa Barbara. And they have the theme of the event is called being an outsider. So, and I'm and I wrote a story for it called Red Cabbage Rising, which is about being a nutritional outsider. And I also have this literary series. It's a nonfiction series called True Story that I want to bring to Santa Barbara that maybe we will be able to host at Antioch University, where we invite anybody in the community who has a 5 to 7 minute true story to come and present and read. So there's an open mic, and then we have a couple higher profile professional writers who come in and read for 10 to 12 minutes. And so it's an event that celebrates storytelling and reading your work to a live audience, but also that celebrates being a human being. And hopefully some are funny and hopefully some are sad, so that, you know, all kinds of different stories are represented.
So I was going to ask you the difference between being an educator and being a journalist, but you sort of answered that question in that description, because in a way you can do both at the same time.
I think, yeah, definitely.
You can educate while writing. And you write not just as you have at the LA Times and other newspapers. You also do freelance work. What kind of freelance work do you do?
Well, my freelance work started out with writing for Good Housekeeping, and then I wrote for a lot of other popular magazines and really enjoyed it. I actually was a freelancer in Los Angeles for a while, but I liked the community aspect more. Mm-hmm. So working and having a newsroom and a place to go was more compelling to me than just kind of being isolated and working on stories. But I always have an interest in freelancing. There's an incredible website called The Manifestation, and run by a woman named Jen Pasteloff, and it's just incredible. So the most recent thing that I published was on there. It was called Gutted. But there are amazing people doing these online magazines. Some are literary, some are more popular writing or more mainstream writing, but they are absolutely amazing.
And you can blog also. You don't even
and
need...
You can blog.
You can blog. And yep. Tell us about True Story.
Well, True Story is a nonfiction series that I started in Sacramento 5 years ago, and it got a big following really quickly. We had about, 100, 150 people show up to the event, and we ran it quarterly. So, and I did go to Speaking of Stories here and absolutely loved it, but this would be more of a regular series that we would hold in town. So I just feel like there's something it is education, because there's something so healing and so funny and wonderful and touching about hearing what's really going on for people in their lives. And that series provides that. It provides that invitation for everybody to come together and sit and just kind of share and marinate in these stories that are touching and funny or embarrassing or and that really interests me. That's part of how I feel like we can help heal each other and heal the world.
Is it ironic that you're involved with something called True Story and you teach nonfiction? They're sort of, you actually have both ends of that in different places.
Well, for me, nonfiction is trying to tell the true story. So
it's not inconsistent.
Not always, no.
Yeah. So you encourage your students who are doing nonfiction to reach down and to look at some of their real life experiences, I suspect.
Well, absolutely. And one of my favorite writers, Lydia Yuknovich, who wrote The Chronology of Water, she's somebody who is kind of crashing these notions of genres. And she believes that we need to have these transferable skills. You know, as a fiction writer, you get trained in fiction and then you bring that to your nonfiction, or you get trained in script writing and you get really good at dialogue and then you bring that into every genre.
Well, thank you so much, Elaine. Elaine
You're
Gale,
welcome.
Who is the writer and performer of One Good Egg on May 6th and May 7th at onegoodeggshow.com. We hope you enjoy the show and we hope you have opportunity to see that show. Thank you so much, Elaine. And we'll be
thank
right
you,
back
Neil.
Here next week.
It's